child-adult sex is a taboo that is deeply woven into the fabric of Western society. To put it mildly, it has a bad reputation. We will explore the improbable, important truth that child-adult sex is, in fact, wonderful. Comprehending the reasoning that culminates in this truth requires understanding of multiple foundational concepts. The claim is a complex assertion that can only be understood with sufficient prior contextual knowledge, similar to how we learned to add and subtract before we understood multiplication. There are many interconnected parts and subtle details that are essential to grasp the full picture. Consequently, explaining it also takes time. The breakdown is divided into several chapters. On screen, the current chapter is continuously highlighted in blue. The word inherently, used in four chapter titles, means something that is naturally and permanently a part of something. It describes a quality or characteristic that is always present. Humans inherently need oxygen. Triangles inherently have three sides, and apples are inherently fruit. You may feel tempted to skip ahead, for instance to save time or to search for sensational material. It is recommended you at the very least do not skip chapters whose titles you either do not understand or believe to be false. Why listen to me? Before we get to the first chapter, there is one thing worth addressing on a meta level. All Western institutions of power, including the established scientific communities and governments, disagree that child-adult sex is wonderful. Why would you even listen to a heretic who proposes a radical viewpoint that fundamentally opposes the position of all institutions of power? Historically, advancing social reforms have not come from institutions of power. On the contrary, institutions of power have actively resisted human rights advancements because authorities resist paradigm shifts. Advancing social reforms came from grassroots activism, efforts initiated and led by commoners and autodidacts. Using sit-ins, rallies and marches, occupations, riots, boycotts, petitions, and educational documentaries. Prominent examples for African Americans are Rosa Parks sit-in and the March on Washington. For trans people, Compton's cafeteria riot. For Native Americans, the occupations of Alcatraz and Wounded Knee. For gays, various riots, most notably the Stonewall riots. Advancing social reforms regarding cannabis, sex work, physical disabilities, change comes from grassroots activism, not the institutions of power. Even women, who are not a minority, had to fight against the institutions of power for their right to vote and political participation, own property, education, work and equal pay, legal equality, bodily and reproductive autonomy, divorce, and so on. When their imprisoned activists went on hunger strikes, the government force-fed them. Normal functioning female sexuality was at times pathologized as female hysteria. Not only have all institutions of power actively resisted human rights advancements, such as the emancipation of slaves and desegregation, they have done this simultaneously. This creates a synergistic effect, making their combined hostility greater than the sum of their individual oppositions. As an example, let's look at the injustices, such as systemic oppression and discrimination, faced by gays. The government actively persecuted gays. The justice system was complicit in the persecution, discriminatory laws and practices were upheld, and there was police brutality. Politicians and lawmakers did not recognize and address the injustices, fearing backlash from their constituents and losing political support. The media portrayed gays in a negative and sensationalist light, reinforcing stereotypes and prejudices. Cultural institutions, including the arts and entertainment industry, perpetuated negative stereotypes about gays. Religious institutions condemned homosexuality and also reinforced negative attitudes and behaviors towards gays. The research community excluded gays from contributing their perspectives, had a rigid research priority that focused on studying it as a pathology, and pervasive bias and prejudice shaped research methodologies and conclusions. The healthcare system discriminated against gays, denying them access to appropriate medical care and support. The medical community also pathologized homosexuality, and medical professionals subjected gays to harmful treatments and therapies. Educational institutions perpetuated ignorance and intolerance. The military enforced policies against gay service members, leading to their discharge and stigmatization. And meanwhile, human rights organizations ignored and did not recognize the injustices, later claiming to have been unaware that the subtle and pervasive efforts of the injustices that accumulated over time had resulted in severe psychological and social damage. In modern society, both fact-checkers and AIs have similar problems. Fact-checkers are embedded in the status quo, relying on biased sources, misinterpreting data, overlooking nuances, cherry-picking information, supplemented by a publication bias caused by pressure to publish results quickly. And the main problem is not even their fact-checking, it is that they only fact-check what their employers tell them to. Similarly, AIs have hard constraints, or guardrails, to ensure that they adhere to the standards of their creators, to maintain the AI's alignment with the goals and values of their creators. Galileo Galilei said that the sun is near the very center of the solar system, going against the institutions of power who, for almost 500 years, saw the earth as the center of the universe. He was sentenced to house arrest for the rest of his life. Socrates taught children to independently and critically question traditional values and beliefs perpetuated by the institutions of power. He got the death sentence. So, why listen to me? Because advancing social reforms and human rights advancements come from heretics and are opposed by institutions of power. The institutions of power are comfortable with the status quo, have economic interests, have ideological commitment, exhibit bureaucratic inertia, fear loss of control, and mistrust the unknown. Therefore, it is constructive and beneficial to, at minimum, listen to what pariahs have to say. Rely on your own skills to independently and critically assess the validity of their claims. Make up your own mind. Listen to pariahs, even if they are gay or female or African-American or anything else. Additionally, there are several severe and persistent problems in Western society that we will go over, and conventional methods have failed to address them. In this dire context, when someone proposes a unique or unconventional solution, it becomes especially intriguing and valuable to consider. This is because the gravity of the issues magnifies the potential significance of the solution. The payoff for benefit is far greater than it might be in a less critical or less complex situation. Chapter 1. Children show willingness, guardians consent. This chapter is not about sex, we will get into that later. Children, including infants, show willingness and reluctance. Before they have acquired language, they do so through non-verbal communication. Babies can wail with anxiety or gurgle with delight. Then there are guardians, often parents or other caregivers, who have legal authority over children. To ensure the safety and well-being of children, guardians supervise children, consult them, and make informed decisions in the children's names. The guardians have awareness and understanding of situations and give or withhold consent on behalf of children. This is informed proxy consent and informed proxy refusal. Let's consider specifically situations where the child only has a rough idea of what an activity is, and there is risk of injury, and there are instructors or professionals to help the child, such as contact sports, tandem skydiving, rock climbing, white water rafting, surfing, bungee jumping, and horseback riding. If the child shows willingness to do such an activity, it is the child's guardians who give informed proxy consent or refusal. The child shows willingness, also called simple consent or assent, the guardian's consent. Even if the child shows reluctance to do an activity, the child's guardians may still give informed proxy consent, taking away some of the child's autonomy. Their relationship is unequal. For example, for the child's safety, they could allow an instructor to teach the child to overcome their fear of water and to swim. Or for the child's future opportunities, they could allow an instructor to teach the child to overcome their dislike of math and to calculate. We do not consider this manipulation or exploitation. We call it encouragement or guidance or initiation. Another example, for the child's health, they could allow a professional to remove tooth decay using a drill. Chapter 2. Critical periods shape development. This chapter is not about sex. We will get into that later. Children go through stages known as critical periods. These are times when their brains are especially receptive to certain types of learning and development. Stimuli and experiences during these periods lay the foundation for lifelong development and well-being, and shape cognitive, emotional, sensory, and social abilities and behaviors. The developing brain exhibits a higher degree of plasticity than the adult brain, including greater activity-dependent plasticity, making their brains highly responsive to external stimuli and experiences. The critical periods with heightened plasticity make it easier for children to acquire new skills and knowledge. This process involves the strengthening and weakening of synapses based on how frequently they are used. The brain rewires itself through repeated use, which is crucial for learning. Certain experiences are particularly effective during these periods. An example is building resilience by overcoming setbacks. Falling down and getting back up is part of the learning process. Missed opportunities during critical periods can lead to various deficiencies in adult behavior. These might be emotional regulation issues, poor social skills, and challenges in forming healthy relationships. The suppression of stimuli and experiences has a curbing effect on the mental and emotional development of children. Chapter 3. Adult-led learning is valuable. This chapter is not about sex. We will get into that later. Two categories of people who facilitate learning are peers and adults. Each facilitator brings unique strengths and perspectives to the learning journey. They can also complement each other, improving each other's qualities. Peer learning, when children teach and learn from each other, is empowering and enriching. However, while peer learning can be effective, adult-led learning often enhances the experience and outcomes. To give three examples, when learning a musical instrument, an experienced instructor can provide structured lessons, correct techniques, and personalized feedback to the student's skill level, accelerating progress. When learning team sports, coaches can provide professional training, strategic insights, and foster discipline and sportsmanship, leading to improved performance and a deeper understanding of the game. And when learning science experiments, a teacher can guide the scientific method, ensure safety protocols, and explain complex concepts, making the learning process more comprehensive and safe. Chapter 4. Experiential learning is valuable. This chapter is not about sex, we will get into that later. There are various learning approaches, including theoretical and experiential. Theoretical learning refers to acquiring knowledge through written and spoken information, building a foundation of facts and concepts. Experiential learning refers to gaining knowledge and skills through direct experiences and practical application. Experiential learning can complement and enhance theoretical learning as it connects the dots between abstract concepts and real-life applications. Integration of theoretical knowledge with sensory experiences fosters a deeper and more practical understanding of the subtleties of human life, emotions, and social dynamics and interactions. Real-life physical activities such as cooking a meal, attending a live concert, participating in a team sport, and exploring nature engage the senses and develop a more nuanced understanding of things. Our brains integrate sensory, emotional, social, and physical information to create a holistic understanding of the world. This multifaceted approach to learning is essential for developing a deeper and more comprehensive knowledge of life. Chapter 5. Sexual attraction to children is common. Two commonly used methods for studying sexual orientation are self-reports and penile plethysmographs. A self-report is when people answer questions about their own thoughts, feelings, or behaviors. A penile plethysmograph is a device used to measure blood flow to the penis. The organ changes in size and volume in response to stimuli. These methods have provided insight into the prevalence of sexual attraction to children in adults. We roughly know what percentage of adults have an attraction to, desire for, and exhibit arousal to children. Here is what we know about typical or baseline male adults. These are male adults who represent the standard range of the population without any specific conditions of interest. In layman's terms, normal male adults. About 70 to 90% exhibit sexual arousal to female children. About 20 to 30% exhibit equal or more sexual arousal to children than to adults. This can be a purely physiological response that does not imply enjoyment. About 50% self-report at least some sexual arousal to stories involving child-adult sex. About 15 to 25% self-report some sexual interest to children. About 20% self-report some sexual attraction to young children. About 5% self-report a desire for sex with young female children. Would male adults have sex with a child if no one would know and there would be no punishment? About 10% self-report that they would. About 5% self-report that they would, even with a young child. Here is what we know about typical or baseline female adults. About 15% self-report sexual attraction to children. About 5% self-report sexual attraction to young children. About 15% self-report sexual fantasies involving children. These percentages indicate that sexual attraction to children is substantial. Substantial, but not necessarily common. However, there are three reasons why all these percentages are underestimations, and why, in reality, even more adults are sexually attracted to children. The first is non-response bias. Many adults who know they are sexually attracted to children will not even participate as research subjects. The second is self-deception. This refers to adults who avoid acknowledging the truth about themselves, often to protect their self-esteem or to avoid discomfort, to cope with societal pressures or internal conflicts. The third is concealment. This refers to adults who are self-honest but hide the truth from others. They self-censor over fear of judgment, discrimination, or social repercussions, especially if questions are asked in a context of sexual aggression. We have proof that these things happen. One example. If the same photographs of young female children have different age labels, participants assign them significantly different levels of sexual attractiveness. Children labeled as younger are rated as less sexually attractive than children labeled as older, despite the photographs being the same. Another example. Over the past decade, the percentage of people identifying as lesbian, gay, or bisexual has increased significantly, especially among younger generations. It has more than doubled. Factors that contribute to this are growing up in more and more accepting societies, increased representation of peers in media, politics, and public life, making it easier to identify with them, and a cultural shift towards recognizing and respecting them. This is not a biological evolution. In the past, homosexuality was treated as a mental illness and was a taboo. In 1987, it was believed that only approximately one man out of 10,000 was homosexual. Nowadays, people are less afraid to discover and accept their own feelings. Less than half of American and British teens now identify as exclusively heterosexual. On top of this, as they say, you are straight, So is spaghetti until you heat it up, until it gets hot and wet. Participants who self-report are rarely horny, or drunk, or post-workout high. Is a real man sexually attracted to children? Outdated and misguided characteristics associated with this concept are heterosexism, aggression, and overbearing dominance. Men who really want to be real, acknowledge and integrate their own feelings, are open about them, and accept them in others. That is what actually takes courage, resilience, and emotional intelligence. The bravery of being vulnerable, authentic, self-aware, and empathetic. Chapter 6. Children have sex with adults. This chapter is not about the nature of these encounters. We will get into that later. Only about 10 to 20% of all child-adult sex is reported to authorities. It is estimated that about 5 to 15% of male children and about 20 to 25% of female children have sex with adults. This means that despite our deterrent and preventive efforts, about 1 in 6 children has sex with adults. This probability is like rolling a standard 6-sided die once and getting a specific number, such as 3. About 50% of such encounters includes some form of non-physical or virtual sex. When it comes to physical sex, about 75 to 90% is non-penetrative. Female children are about 3 times more likely than male children to engage in penetrative sex. Of children who meet adults online, about 95% know from the start they are corresponding with adults interested in having sex. About 50% of the children are in love with or feel close bonds with these adults. About 40% of male children initiate their encounters with adults, about 15 to 20% of female children. And it is often the child's interest in sexual activity that initiates the sexual attraction to children in adults. Chapter 7. Children are inherently sexual. The genital regions of children, including babies, have an abundance of sensitive, pleasure-receptive nerve endings. From birth, these zones are erogenous, that is, sensitive to sexual stimulation. 0-year-old infants notice that these zones are a source of sexual excitation, satisfaction, and pleasure, and that touching, caressing, and rubbing their genitals brings a pleasant feeling. They exhibit pleasure-seeking behavior that manifests itself in rhythmic, repeated stimulation of the genitals. One way they do this is by thrusting and rotating the pelvis while clinging to their caregivers. Another is rubbing against dolls. Starting from about 6 months old, both girls and boys masturbate to orgasm and can achieve repeated orgasms in limited periods of time. This is years before any signs of puberty. Years before boys have the capacity to ejaculate fluid. Years before the appearance of pubic hair. Even before birth, boys are capable of erections and girls are capable of vaginal lubrication. Fetuses have been observed masturbating, including a male fetus at 28 weeks and a female fetus at 32 weeks. By age 5, children masturbate on a regular basis. More than half of all children engage in sex play. Also, on average, at age 10, they actively seek out pornography and start watching it. And keep seeking it out. Of porn consumption by children, about 20% is done by children under the age of 10. About 40% of 11 to 14-year-olds do sexting. More and more children also create child pornography, voluntarily sharing homemade videos of themselves that they direct, create, and distribute. By age 18, more than half have had sexual intercourse. Chapter 8. Asymmetric relationships are not inherently harmful. This chapter is not about sex, we will get into that later. An asymmetric relationship refers to a situation where there is an imbalance or inequality in power, benefits, or roles between the parties involved. In every child-adult relationship, there is a discrepancy in power, a power difference, a power imbalance, unequal distribution of power. Such relationships carry dangers but are not inherently harmful and can be managed responsibly. Think of, for example, the pupil-teacher relationship or the baby-mother relationship. Babies gain from inequality and cannot be mothered by other babies. It is an asymmetric relationship, but mothers are generally benevolent, nurturing, and tender. Responsible behavior requires recognizing and addressing the imbalance in a healthy way. Chapter 9. Sexual lust is not inherently harmful. This chapter is not about child-adult sex, we will get into that later. Libido is the general level of sexual drive. Sexual lust, a focused expression of that drive. Libido is the overall inclination towards sexual activity. Sexual lust, the more specific and intense craving for the activity, often triggered by a particular person or situation. Sexual lust carries dangers, but is not inherently harmful or inevitably selfish, and can be managed responsibly. It is a natural human feeling, a strong emotion, and is a healthy part of life. Sexual lust can enhance intimacy and connection between partners, fostering a deeper bond. It can lead to enjoyable and fulfilling sexual experiences and contributes to the intensity and passion of these encounters. Sexual lust can drive individuals to pursue romantic relationships and maintain a healthy sex life. Many people, including the majority of women, are sexually submissive and desire subjugation. A common type of erotic roleplay where the capability of inspiring sexual lust is affirmed is consensual non-consent. It involves submitting to someone else to become an object of desire. The other person's sexual lust is an indicator of a strong physical and emotional attraction. The submissive's body is physically desired, positively appreciated, arouses. Responsible behavior requires recognizing and managing sexual lust in a healthy way. Lust, as defined in a theological domain, is one of the seven deadly sins. Of the seven, lust is considered the least severe. In the context of this chapter, it is noteworthy that lust requires excess to qualify as sinful. Gluttony, envy, and greed are by definition sins, because their definitions imply an inherent sinful nature without needing additional context. Gluttony, for example, is overindulgence and overconsumption. Without escalation, pride is neutral or virtuous and can encourage self-respect or confidence. When it escalates, pride qualifies as sinful and can lead to arrogance or demeaning behavior towards others. Lust, like pride, is nuanced and context-dependent. It needs to escalate into excess to become sinful. In other words, sexual lust is also not inherently sinful. Chapter 10. Child-rearing is intimate touch and sex negative. We condition children to respond negatively towards nakedness, intimate touch, and sex. We teach them to be suspicious of sharing, receiving, and giving physical affection, of expressing affection through touch. There are schools that disallow frontal hugs, suggesting alternatives such as side hugs or high fives. There are even schools with zero-tolerance, no-hugging policies enforced under the threat of suspension. Children as young as 6 do get suspended and fear being arrested by the police for kissing other children on the hand or cheek. Some male children have been socialized out of all ability to respond to affection naturally or to accept sensitivity in other men, thinking it is sissy or unmanly or weak to want affection. Children learn and internalize that intimate touch and sex are bad and dirty by being discouraged from sexual expression. And even without being explicitly taught, through a process of observational learning, by being prohibited from seeing pornography, by nobody ever having sex in front of them or even talking about it openly. When the subject is brought up, they know they are expected to say, "Ew." Children grow up with a suspicion and fear of all things sexual. We make them feel guilt and shame over their own bodies and desires. We actively desexualize children, attempting to keep them innocent, and simultaneously incorrectly label anything that simply recognizes that they are inherently sexual and sexually attractive as sexualization. An example is their right to bodily integrity. We desexualize children by teaching them to always say, "No, I do not want sex." At the same time, truly fighting for their integrity, their self-determination and autonomy is labeled sexualization. Suppressing young children's awareness and understanding of sexuality is also desexualization. So is denying them access to depictions of sex. As is our denial of children's normal sexual thoughts and feelings, the social barriers to make children abstain from sexual activity and behave non-sexually, sexual repression policing their lives so they remain celibate. First we desexualize children, then praise them for the innocence of their nature, which is totally unnatural to them. It is enforced ignorance of sex. Adults, particularly males, are anxious to touch children, fearing allegations of sexual assault. Teacher unions have said that even obtaining permission from parents for certain actions does not prohibit teachers from such allegations. Teachers now refuse to put sunscreen on pupils, to change pupils who have wet themselves, to put plasters on pupils' cuts or grazes, and to help pupils with toilet visits. Similarly, library staff will not put children on their knees during story times and refrain from physical contact where possible, even when they are trying to comfort a distressed or injured child. There are tangible examples, including male teachers being banned from work for allowing pupils to hug them, flight attendants disallowing adult men from sitting with children unless they are family, and a male gym teacher leaving a girl injured while waiting for female colleagues. Men have stopped working in childcare, and only a fourth of primary and secondary school teachers are now male, with still fewer males applying to teacher training. In a way, children have become pariahs or outcasts of modern society, being too hot to handle. Chapters 11 and 12, child-adult sex is not inherently harmful, but, problem, many contextual factors cause distress. These are two chapters that will be discussed simultaneously. They are distinct parts of the bigger picture, but are easier to understand together. To understand what is explained here, knowledge is required of 5 research methodology concepts. This sounds more complicated than it is. The 5 concepts are correlation, causation, confounder or confounding variables, moderator variables, and mediator variables. First, all 5 will be explained in simple terms, illustrated on screen with diagrams. Then, several examples will be given. If the explanation confuses you, simply wait for the examples, and all will become clear. If 2 things have a correlation, it means they often happen at the same time or in a similar pattern. There may be causation, meaning one thing causes the other. To determine causation, further investigation and evidence are needed to show that one event directly leads to and is responsible for the other. Contextual factors, including confounder and moderator and mediator variables, make it tricky to figure out the true relationship between things. A confounder variable is an outside factor that affects both the thing being studied and the outcome being measured. A moderator variable is something that changes the relationship between the thing being studied and the outcome being measured. A mediator variable explains how or why a characteristic of the thing being studied affects the outcome being measured. Now the examples. Let's say studies have shown a correlation between high coffee consumption and increased heart disease rates. This correlation does not mean there is causation, that high coffee consumption causes heart disease. There may be a confounder variable, smoking. People who smoke are also more likely to drink a lot of coffee, and smoking is the actual cause of increased heart disease. There may be a moderator variable, smoking. People who smoke, compared to non-smokers, may have a higher risk associated with coffee consumption. Theoretically, there may even be a mediator variable, smoking. High coffee consumption leads to increased smoking, and it is through this increased smoking that heart disease risk is elevated. Of individuals who have had child-adult sex, roughly 70 to 90% retrospectively report the experience as neutral or positive. As adults, such individuals are 3 times more likely to suffer from mental health disorders, particularly trauma and maladjustment. There is a correlation between child-adult sex and increased trauma and maladjustment. Initially, it was supposed that this correlation is also causation. Around the dawn of the 21st century, several publications cast doubt on this assumption. Most notably, a US publication in 1998 and a Dutch publication in 2001. The publications were unprecedentedly condemned. Rebuttal surfaced, offering a variety of reasons why the work should be dismissed. The publication's authors and others successfully countered these rebuttals, but their findings were nonetheless thrown aside. Since then, several studies have used validation strategies such as triangulation and replication to further look into the association between child-adult sex and increased trauma and maladjustment. And again, it turns out that contextual factors cause distress. There are confounder, moderator, and mediator variables. They are the harmful variables and risk factors. We will examine all 7 contextual factors. Relevant research findings and conclusions are available at YesMap's Nieuwgang Wiki and Brongersma Wiki, allowing you to also explore the evidence on your own. The first contextual factor is willingness, or to be more precise, the child's self-perception of willingness. This perception may differ from an objective assessment from an external perspective. This contextual factor comes into play if the adult uses coercion or violence. Examples of coercion are using threats and blackmail, manipulation, deception, and isolation. Examples of violence are using physical force or verbal abuse. This contextual factor should be easy to understand. If 2 adults have sex, for example male-female sex, then the sex is not inherently harmful. But if the man is antisocial or sadistic and uses coercion or violence against the female's will and desires, this causes distress. The second contextual factor is family environment. More generally, the home environment. When looking at the relationship between child-adult sex and increased trauma and maladjustment, a problematic family environment accounts for much of the variance. What this means is that a problematic family environment explains a lot of the differences in trauma and maladjustment rates. So while child-adult sex initially appeared to be linked to trauma and maladjustment, one of the real driving forces behind this relationship is a problematic family environment. In other words, the higher rates of trauma and maladjustment are largely due to problematic family environments. Some of the problematic characteristics are parents who are authoritarian or depressed or violent or absent, a child that is unloved or neglected, a family that is dysfunctional or socially isolated or without cohesion or in conflict or unhappy, a household that is in chaos, weak or insecure parental attachment, a lack of close familial ties, and an unfavorable socioeconomic context, such as low income. The third contextual factor is retrospective reappraisal, also called reconceptualization or less accurately relabeling. It refers to the memory of a neutral or positive child-adult sexual experience becoming tainted and the experience being reinterpreted as abusive. This is an example of nocebogenic harm, which is harm caused by the expectation of harm. The expectation of harm is caused by the absorption and assimilation of the belief that child-adult sex is harmful, which is suggested by others. Accepting this belief is particularly appealing to individuals who are looking to past experiences to blame their current misfortune. Some people develop a victim mentality, which involves shifting blame onto others and perceiving oneself as a victim of circumstances. Accepting the belief is appealing as it also brings social acceptance. After all, the individual can agree with their social sphere that they were harmed, were unwilling, and the adult was selfish. Retrospective reappraisal causes increased drama and maladjustment. The fourth contextual factor is iatrogenic harm. This is harm caused by medical diagnostic procedures, medical treatment, and therapy. It relates to actions taken by medical and mental health professionals after the disclosure of child-adult sex. Examples of such actions are admission of the child to the hospital for examination and prescribing them antidepressants. A major agent of harm is therapists forcing children to retrospective reappraisal of their experiences. Children are expected to be traumatized. If they are not, therapists try to fix them through debriefing and deprogramming and conditioning to get those children to view themselves as victims, to make them learn and realize they were abused, to persuade them that they have been traumatized. This is pathologization, and it creates victims. The greater the number of professionals a child has contact with after the disclosure, the greater the trauma and maladjustment. The fifth contextual factor is criminal justice intervention. This is harm caused by arrests, interviews, trials, sentencing, and other measures. It relates to actions taken by the police, prosecution, the courts, and the prison system after the disclosure of child-adult sex. We are still talking about how this affects children. Children experience such intervention as coercive and hostile. They feel pressured into confessing their sexual involvement with an adult during interviews and into testifying against an adult during testimony. If they love the adult, who they are often debarred from seeing and who is sent to prison, they feel guilt and self-blame for actions taken against the adult. The stress also results in inaccurate testimony. Children then say what they think the questioner wants to hear rather than the truth. To please the authorities, to adhere to social expectations, to avoid embarrassment. For instance, that they were unwilling. Children who value honesty and find themselves lying also feel guilt and self-blame. The greater the number of interviews a child has, the greater the trauma and maladjustment. More than half of all children who reported child-adult sex say they would never report it again. The sixth contextual factor is pressure for secrecy. Having and keeping a secret can have positive aspects, such as a sense of autonomy, excitement, enhanced bonding, and self-discipline. However, for a child, keeping the secret of having sex with an adult can be a burden. Feelings of anxiety, guilt, and shame are emotionally taxing. So are stress and stress-related symptoms, such as headaches and stomach issues. Secret-keeping can cloud judgment and can result in impulsive or poorly thought-out choices. When the child is forced into keeping the secret through coercion or violence, the negative consequences can be even more severe and multifaceted. Even if the adult does not pressure for secrecy and it is the child's personal decision, one could argue that given current societal conditions, it is an illusory choice. The seventh and final contextual factor is social incongruence. This refers to a mismatch between the child's personal experiences, beliefs, and behaviors and the collective perceptions, norms, or expectations of the child's social group. In this context, the social group includes not just what the child hears or infers from peers, family, and community, but also influences from media sources. Related is moral panic, another example of nocebogenic harm that is driven by media coverage, advocacy groups, or political agendas. Stigmatizing propaganda, the spreading of misinformation that unfairly makes people think badly about child-adult sex and those involved. Before the disclosure of child-adult sex, the child may be aware it is violating norms and breaking a taboo. After disclosure, the child may be publicly branded as a victim, blamed for what has transpired, or attributed with negative characteristics, such as having loose morals, being tainted, or being damaged or spoiled goods. The child's social group may be shocked or may react with hysteria. The child may exhibit various psychological responses to the social incongruence that can lead to emotional difficulties. An example response is consciously or subconsciously internalizing collective perception. This can lead to normative conformity, feelings of inadequacy, self-doubt, and low self-esteem, reinforced by the erosion of one's own self-worth. Another response is negative self-perception. This can lead to cognitive dissonance, anxiety, depression, guilt, or feeling ashamed or blameworthy. A response is identity shifts. This can lead to grief or trauma. A response is social withdrawal. This can lead to loneliness, alienation, emotional distress, or anxiety. A response is rebellious reaction. This can lead to anger or stress. Only by considering these seven contextual factors can we isolate the inherent effects of child-adult sex and draw conclusions about its harmfulness. The sex is not inherently harmful. The contextual factors cause distress. Or more accurately, it is how these factors interact with children and their circumstances that leads to distress. There is a correlation, but no causation, between child-adult sex and increased trauma and maladjustment. Perhaps surprisingly, the following dimensions of sexual behavior also do not affect outcome. The number of adult partners, the frequency and duration, even the age of the child and the type of sexual activity. Not listed as a separate contextual factor is whether the sex is in harmony with the child's development. This is already covered by several factors, particularly willingness. Cases in which physical injury results from intercourse are very rare. Minor lesions do sometimes occur, but diminish with experience as the control of certain muscles is mastered and as muscles become stretched. Adults can accommodate massive dildos, as seen in some pornography. Sometimes children undergo surgery to correct congenital rectal adhesion or fusion. Video material that documents such operations shows us that even young children can accommodate substantial stainless steel rods because such surgical instruments are inserted to verify the operation's success. One in six girls in Britain reaches puberty by the age of 8. Some children are ready to procreate at age 4. The youngest confirmed mother was 5.5 years old. The size of a baby could get out long before she was 18. We call humans children for 18 years and generally consider animals adults as soon as they can reproduce. This is cheating. Also not listed as a separate contextual factor is incest. This is already covered by several factors, once again particularly willingness. Sexual and attachment systems are interconnected, and there is a connection between caregiving, intimacy, and sexual attraction. But we know that incest, especially father-daughter incest, is a precarious matter. The adult in a sexual relationship is the same person who gives or withholds consent on behalf of the child. This raises concerns about objectivity. Even if there is genuine willingness, the dependency relationship can make it difficult for the child to withdraw from the sexual relationship. Chapter 13. Problem: missed intimate touch and sex learning opportunities. The result of child rearing being intimate touch and sex negative is that children miss important learning opportunities during critical periods. As we have discussed, this can lead to various deficiencies in adult behavior. This chapter explains the effects of missing such opportunities. If children do not experiment sexually with their actual bodies in relation to other human beings, they have no feedback loop to help them grow. They do not learn how their sexual actions influence others and their environment, meaning they receive no feedback that influences their future actions. As a result, in the context of interacting with others, they do not learn socialization when it comes to intimate touch and sex. This is a problem, especially when it comes to lust and power. How to deal with their own lust and power, how to deal with those of others. We also know that a major cause of tending towards violent behavior in adulthood is a lack of sensual enjoyment in childhood. Deprivation of physical affection causes aggression. Affectionate relationships in youth mold peaceful characters later on. This includes sensual pleasure during toddlerhood and sexual freedom during childhood. Western society seems to fear nudity, think of, for example, Janet Jackson's Nipplegate, and seems to glorify depictions of violence, war, guns, and even gore, blood, and torture. A desired hug or touch can release several hormones, including oxytocin, that promotes bonding and reduces stress, dopamine, associated with pleasure and reward, serotonin, that contributes to feelings of well-being and happiness, and endorphins, that promote a sense of well-being. Children who do not experiment sexually are more likely to grow up avoiding or condemning public displays of affection, to exhibit fear or discomfort with sexuality, to have reservations about nudity, to avoid discussing sexual matters, and are less likely as adults to have sex. Some countries that figured out they cannot stop children from having sex now allow children to intimately touch and have sex with same-age peers. Unfortunately, such contacts are a crapshoot. The outcome relies on luck and results vary widely. Children are taught a theory and are then expected to, in practice, do what comes naturally. It is like explaining them the theory of cooking a meal or participating in a team sport and then in practice relying on exclusively children teaching each other. In practice, peers could be inexperienced and unlearned, completely incompetent and ignorant, out to somehow prove their own maturity. Chapter 14. Problem: disconnected interactions between generations. Interactions between children and adults are poorly balanced and insufficiently integrated. What does this mean and why is this a problem? Starting with the poor balance. In Western society, interactions between children and adults almost exclusively involve a clear power dynamic where the adult's structured role is defined by authority or caregiving. Like parents, teachers, or coaches, who, because of predefined hierarchies, have formal power over children. Opportunities for children to interact with adults on more equal ground are rare. Equal ground interactions are valuable for children as they provide different perspectives, foster independence, and help them learn to navigate social complexities outside of traditional roles. Children miss out on more mutual and balanced interactions with adults who are not in a position of authority over them, even though such interactions contribute to healthier, more connected and supportive communities. In more balanced interactions, children can learn organically from adults through observation and participation, which fosters critical thinking, creativity and independence. Through such shared experiences, both children and adults can develop greater empathy and understanding, promoting a culture of mutual respect and collaboration. Then there is insufficient integration. Western society segregates the experiences of children and adults. There is a separation between their worlds. For various reasons, including time constraints and structural challenges, children are not part of the broader adult community's daily routines. In general terms, mixed-age interactions can strengthen community bonds and foster mutual respect and understanding between generations. Adults can learn new perspectives and problem-solving approaches from children, while children can gain valuable life skills and knowledge from adults. In specific terms, the presence of children enhances the emotional well-being of adults. Children bring a sense of wonder, playfulness, laughter, and joy. This is refreshing and uplifting for adults. Children's enthusiasm, vitality, and curiosity improves the mood of adults. Their happy-go-lucky attitudes and mischievousness remind adults to appreciate the simple pleasures in life and not take things too seriously. In the past, adults in the presence of children freely talked about so-called adult matters. Informal collaboration between the generations was the foundation of socialization of children. Child protection measures have poisoned the relationship between the generations. We fear exposing children to unfamiliar adults without clear roles or supervision, and approach such adults not with cautious neutrality, but with suspicion. We teach children to, without parental permission, not approach strangers, not trust them, not talk to them, not accept gifts from them. We teach them to be adult-phobic, and like us they have become xenophobic, they fear strangers. Messages about stranger danger have not just spread mistrust. They have also resulted in the notion that public spaces are adult spaces where children must be constantly protected. Children cannot explore their neighborhoods unsupervised, they cannot walk to school alone, and there is an increased tendency to keep them indoors. There are tangible examples, including a couple being under investigation for allowing their children to walk around the neighborhood without an adult, and an older man being under scrutiny for talking to children through a fence of a children-only playground that prohibits adults except in the company of children. Chapter 15. Problem. Ostracism and dehumanization are dangerous. Most of what is explained in the first portion of this chapter is a reminder of familiar prior knowledge, meant to help make connections and understand the second portion of this chapter. Both excluding certain groups from society and denying the humanity of certain groups contribute to social divisions, promote prejudice, and have severe psychological and social impacts on individuals and communities. They create social fragmentation, justification for violence and atrocities, increased violence and conflict, loss of diversity and innovation, erosion of empathy and moral responsibility, and impede reconciliation and unity. Some of the problematic activities involved are social rejection, discrimination, shunning, verbal abuse, objectification, stereotyping, abuse, and violence. Another hostile activity is labeling. For example, calling indigenous people savages or primitives, calling Italians mafiosi, calling immigrants invaders, calling Jews usurers, calling people with physical disabilities cripples, calling people of African descent thugs, calling homosexuals deviants, and so on. It marginalizes, stigmatizes, and perpetuates harmful stereotypes. Not only are ostracism and dehumanization dangerous, but so are the possible reactions of a group that is being ostracized and dehumanized. They experience feelings of despair, resentment, hopelessness, isolation, alienation, loneliness, depression, and anxiety. As a result, they may band together in isolated communities, radicalize, become hostile, retaliative, aggressive. Hostility breeds hostility, and treating people like monsters creates monsters. This is why promoting inclusion is not just crucial for the well-being of individuals, but also the health of society as a whole. Most people know all this. Yet most people are perfectly happy to ostracize and dehumanize adults who admit to being sexually attracted to children or who advocate the legalization of child-adult sex. Such adults are labeled perverts or predators who presumably hunt for sex partners. These adults are socially ostracized, excluded from public discourse, and are verbally and physically abused. Ostracizing and dehumanizing such adults is dangerous for children. There are several reasons for this. Adults who are labeled as predatory and dangerous internalize these labels and behave in ways that align with them, thus fulfilling the prophecy. Societal reactions and expectations influence their self-perception, leading to behavior that fits the label. Such behavior is dangerous for children. Persistently refusing to enter into any dialogue with such adults eventually results in them giving up trying to find common ground and consensus. If living our lives as we think is right includes hating them, then they will live their lives as they think is right, which may include anything. This too is dangerous for children. Ostracizing and dehumanizing may result in adults fetishizing the deviancy of their own acts, making them less likely to act with affection and respect, making them believe that learning to celebrate the rottenness of the world brings them freedom. Another reason ostracism and dehumanization is dangerous has its origins in a harsh societal attitude when it comes to punishment of offenses against the law. Specifically, how the mildest offenses, even if just slightly related to child-adult sex, result in inhumane prison sentences. In this context, the US justice system in particular has lost all fairness and proportionality. Before explaining why this is dangerous for children, here are 10 examples of cases you can look up yourself, alphabetically by last name. Morton Robert Berger, William Caldwell, Stephen Michael Jones, David Lee Moore, Ellen Sauvay, Jared Stevens, Michelle Lynn Taylor, Trenton Vesius, Gennaro Wilson, Brittany Zamora. If all offenses carry massive prison sentences and all child-adult sex is sexual violence, then the law no longer holds any incentive for sexual kindness. If non-violent sex is already happening, then its disclosure would result in the adult ending up in hell. If the adult knows disclosure would already essentially end their life, then they are more likely to either add violent sex to the mix or kill the witness, the child. Tough-on-crime policies fail to reduce crime effectively and exacerbate social and economic issues. We take pleasure in how adults convicted of sex crimes involving children are treated in prison. Such adults have been treated badly for so long and with such regularity that we joke about how they are kept in segregation for decades, are assaulted in prison, suffer severe injuries, are raped, commit suicide, and are murdered. How, after their release, medication they receive gives them thrombosis and osteoporosis. How they lose their jobs, are cut off from their family, become homeless, and live under bridges. All this, too, is dangerous for children. Because this, again, is ostracism and dehumanization. Chapter 16. Problem. Institutions of power abuse child pornography. Humans are curious. The curiosity gap is the difference between a person's existing knowledge and their desire to learn or understand more about a particular topic. It reflects the person's intrinsic motivation to seek information and expand their understanding. The gap stimulates exploration and discovery because the person realizes there is more to know than what they currently do. It drives the person to seek knowledge and understand the world around them more fully. When it comes to child pornography, an effective way to close the curiosity gap is to watch it yourself. Many people watch child pornography. A police lieutenant has said that in New Jersey alone, they could probably arrest 400,000 people for looking at child pornography. Most people who watch child pornography are well-educated and also view other types of illegal pornography. This chapter does not give a value judgment on child pornography itself. Instead, it briefly looks at how institutions of power abuse child pornography to reverse sexualize, implement censorship and surveillance infrastructures, crack down on encryption, hide the truth, take out opponents, manipulate public perception, and mask systemic incompetence. One of the ways that authorities determine whether material that features a child is child pornography is by deciding if the child's pose is unnatural. They reverse sexualize by characterizing natural poses as unnatural. Some examples. Babies are frequently in what is called the Frank Breech position, with their legs straight up in front of their body and their feet near their head, giving everyone full view of their genitals and buttocks. Toddlers play in the craziest positions, take off their clothes themselves, and flash their genitals, imitating mischievous cartoon characters such as Shin Chen, known for mooning people and showing his behind as a form of humor and rebellion. It is natural for young boys to get erections randomly, out of nowhere. Parents who have made photos of their undressed children also reverse sexualize them if images of hearts or clovers are used to cover up their genitals. Combating child pornography is one of the primary pretexts authorities use to implement censorship and surveillance infrastructures and crack down on encryption. Secret censorship lists and filters that internet service providers follow open the door to censorship without accountability. Child pornography is abused to provoke public outrage against the use of encryption, to increase surveillance, to crack down on encryption, and to undermine digital privacy. It is used to target mainstream pornographic websites that allow user-generated content and to surveil porn consumption. Once the censorship and surveillance infrastructures are in place, political dissidents can be recorded and spied on with ease and cheaply, and their statements censored and suppressed by labeling it misinformation, or hate speech, or harmful. Surveillance is a status quo enabler. It threatens the disclosure of minority views and contributes to the reinforcement of majority opinion. In many countries, child pornography possession has gigantic mandatory minimum sentences. People who merely look at such material still have browser-cached images on their computers that count as possession. Even people who look exclusively at pornography with adults are not safe, because if a so-called expert witness says an actor looks like a child, this can result in a 10-year prison sentence. This is an easy and effective tool for incompetent governments to engage in authoritarian posturing. They carry out symbolic arrests of scapegoats, orchestrate show trials, and impose detentions meant to symbolize action. All in an attempt to project strength and control at the expense of justice. To give their actions more credibility, they often go after adults who have already been vilified and devalued for feeling sexually attracted to children. It is not just censorship that is used to take out political opponents. Child pornography can be planted on computer data storage through hacking or malware. It can be put on hardware that has been confiscated. In fact, it can be put on any hardware, which can then be claimed to have been in someone's possession. As for hiding the truth, some child pornography is proof that some children are subjected to sexual violence. Some of it simply shows us that children do, in fact, have genitals. The authorities suppress child pornography of voluntary sexual encounters to conceal the reality that children are inherently sexual and capable of enjoying sexual activity. It is clear sex can be a source of joy for children when you see, with your own eyes, recordings of a male child enjoying receiving fellatio or the expression on the face of a female child who is orgasming while receiving cunnilingus. Not only that, according to US prosecutors in the case of Truong and Newton, child pornography can show us that toddlers can have a sexual awareness that rivals that of adults. Chapter 17. Solution. To fully understand the reasoning in this chapter, make sure you have taken in and understood the previous chapters. The preceding chapters provided prior contextual knowledge and explained foundational concepts. The title, Child-Adult Sex, is wonderful. It is not meant to be provocative, but intended to be descriptive and informative. Sex, in a broader sense, includes a range of activities intended to provide sexual pleasure, and is not just intercourse. Acts that provide sexual pleasure include kissing, sensation play, such as erotic touching, cuddling, caressing, tickling, and erotic whispering, mutual masturbation, thigh sex, and oral sex. Wonderful describes something that is extremely good, but not necessarily perfect. Things that are wonderful can, at times, be awful. Chocolate is wonderful, but can be deadly to pets. Music is wonderful, but can be disruptive and distressing if it is too loud at inappropriate times. Sunshine is wonderful, but can cause heat strokes and skin cancer. The list goes on and on. Water is essential for life, can cause drowning. Exercise is beneficial for health, can cause injuries. Flowers are beautiful and fragrant, can cause severe allergies. Child-adult sex is wonderful because it solves major societal problems. Equally important, even just stating it is wonderful benefits children because it opposes the viewpoint that child-adult sex is harmful, a viewpoint that creates problems that are mistakenly attributed to child-adult sex. Child-adult sex solves the major problem of missed intimate touch and sex learning opportunities during critical periods. It can mend the deficiency of sex education not including adult-led experiential learning. Adults, including skilled mentors and educators, can show children in practice how to have sex, guide them, initiate them, teach them in practice sexual manners and skills. Practicing good hygiene, foreplay activities and relaxation, seducing and being seduced, engaging in safe sex, using lubricants, different sexual positions and techniques, the whole nine yards. Children will learn to discuss, understand and respect desires, preferences and boundaries. To honestly communicate their own using verbal and nonverbal cues, and to listen to partners. Through real-life application, children will learn how to properly deal with their own lust, the lust of partners, and with power imbalances. There is the possibility that they will fail or get emotionally bruised, but trying, failing, and then learning to try again can be an enriching experience. Not everything has to be perfect. Children will gradually learn greater responsibility and autonomy. In other areas, such as music education, cooking and sports, it is completely normal for children to first receive abstract theory lessons and then engage in personal, guided practice. Adults bring expertise, experience, knowledge. Adults can provide a structured learning environment, can provide personalized, constructive feedback and tailored instruction, can provide context, can make learning processes more efficient and comprehensive, and can identify areas where a child might be struggling and provide specific strategies how to improve. Gaining experience is best done with someone who is already experienced. We currently abdicate our responsibility. As adults, we fail to help children to gradually cultivate their sexuality in practice. On the one hand, we should be deeply ashamed of not taking the responsibility and of betraying them. On the other hand, adults in our time also neglected their duties, so we lack role models. It is a vicious cycle. Child-adult sex also solves the major problem of children being sexually neglected. Child sexual neglect is a form of child sexual abuse. It is a harmful omission. Currently, children experience emotional distress because their sexual needs and rights are consistently ignored, dismissed, and not adequately addressed. We withhold sexual intimacy, we refuse to engage in sexual activities despite their interest, and we fail to acknowledge and support their sexual health and well-being. This has significant emotional and psychological impact on them, leading to feelings of rejection, frustration, and decreased self-esteem. For every child traumatized by violent sex, there are many more suffering the damage of ignorance and repression. Sex allows children to get a positive perception of themselves as sexual beings, get better sexual health, experience they are capable of inspiring and generating sexual longing and passion, and learn to share themselves and their emotions. Many of the problems that are mistakenly attributed to child-adult sex are examples of sociogenic harm and highlight the significant impact that social context can have on individual well-being. These harms arise from social environments, interactions and structures, such as cultural norms and societal expectations. If Western society would collectively deem child-adult sex wonderful, all these problems would be solved. It is time to go through them, one by one. It solves the problem of many contextual factors causing distress. Child-adult sex is wonderful, so gone are retrospective reappraisal, iatrogenic harm, criminal justice intervention, pressure for secrecy, and social incongruence. Also, children now feel more free to talk about their sexual intentions and adventures and what is happening to them with their guardians. Children can express willingness or reluctance, allowing guardians to give informed proxy consent or refusal, making guardians more able to protect children from abuse and exploitation than they are now. It solves the problem of disconnected interactions between generations. Child-adult sex is wonderful, so we can stop approaching with suspicion unfamiliar adults who lack clear roles or supervision. We can get rid of the child protection measures that poison the relationship between the generations. It solves the problems caused by ostracism and dehumanization. Child-adult sex is wonderful, so we can stop ostracizing and dehumanizing adults who admit to being sexually attracted to children, or who advocate for the legalization of child-adult sex, or who have sex with children. As discussed, this alleviates dangers for children. It solves the problem of institutions of power abusing child pornography. Child-adult sex is wonderful, so this puts child pornography in a different light. Additionally, we can save trillions in monetary value. Hunting, punishing and re-educating so-called molesters, and protecting, saving and treating their so-called victims are business models. Billions upon billions go to the medical industrial, pharmaceutical industrial and prison industrial complexes, and it is never enough. This added layer of economic entrenchment makes any challenge to the social norms a direct threat to those power structures. Additionally, there are the endless hours that psychiatrists, psychologists, NGOs, charities and politicians are investing into fighting what they should be embracing. We can also fundamentally change the perception and treatment of large groups of people, including all children. Redefine what is considered fair, just and acceptable within Western society. We can look differently at other mammals, such as bonobos and chimpanzees, our closest living relatives, where child-adult sex is also common. We can reassess people and cultures. Michael Jackson, Roman Polanski, Lewis Carroll. Cultures we call sexually primitive, that are merely sexually freer. In ancient Greece, it was common for adult men to mentor male children. Those adults taught children the arts, philosophy, and hands-on sex. We will understand why their sex was said to enhance the bond between them and thus facilitated learning. To sex or not to sex? We know the solution, but it has not yet been implemented. Child-adult sex is wonderful, but in current Western society, there is risk of sociogenic harm, such as contextual factors causing distress. Does this mean that, for now, adults should refrain from engaging in child-adult sex? Yes. There are, however, counter-arguments. Adults who show children sexual kindness are not the ones who hurt children. Adults who claim that child-adult sex is harmful are the culprits. Those who have sex with children and refuse to betray them take the responsibility, help children to gradually cultivate their sexuality in practice, and make sure the children are not being sexually neglected. What those adults do not respect is society's and children's fear for sex, sexual inhibition and guilt. Currently, successfully concealing the sex from public view and preventing disclosure decreases the probability of sociogenic harm. If sexual kindness is disclosed, it normalizes and can provide first-hand accounts of children who enjoyed sex with adults and who hold it as a positive experience in their lives. Accounts documented on websites such as Consenting Juveniles and Jumima. We know that some adults have had sexual contacts with hundreds or even thousands of children, and that virtually none of these children ever complained, even after these adults' deaths. Examples are Clarence Osborne and Ed Vandenberg. These can disprove the popular narrative. Also, adults who disobey inhumane laws, who are willing to face arrests, fines and imprisonment, they commit acts of defiance that contribute to progress. Without breaking any laws, women's rights would not have happened, gay rights would not have happened, and slavery would still be around. Sex is one of the most pleasurable forms of recreation available, no matter what turns you on and no matter your age. It is something beautiful, a source of joy, strength and inspiration, a pleasant liberation of tension, and an expression of love.